Second.
Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, Monday, April 22nd. Vice Chair Marsh has noted that we are small but mighty this morning. A couple of members will not be with us at all. And I am announcing that, do I open and then carry over the work sessions or just announce carryover? I am carrying over work sessions on House Bill 3135, 3136, 3137, and 3138. Those bills are not quite ready, and we will carry them over to tomorrow. I am opening a work session on House Bill 2449A.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. 2449 deals with the 911 fee that is currently at 75 cents. This measure would increase that fee to $1.50 per month or per transaction for those that are prepaid, reduces the limit on the amount of reimbursement for administrative costs for the Oregon Emergency Management, and also specifies that the interest earned from the emergency communications account be credited to the corresponding sub-account.
Thank you. We have a lot of people signed up to testify. I am hoping to get through everyone today. It may be difficult. After we hear from Representative Findley on this bill, in public testimony, you will be limited to 2 minutes each. Representative Findley.
Thank you, Chair Nathan. And I will attempt to be brief. Thank you. Okay, thank you. For the record, my name is Lynn Finley. I'm the state representative from House District 60, serving Baker, Grant, Harney, Malheur, and part of Lake County. Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Marsh, Representative Fernandez. I'm here to urge you to support House Bill 2449. I'll give you a little background on this issue. The 911 surcharge, and you're going to hear me say 911, you're going to hear me say PSAP. PSAP is Public Safety Answering Point. It was originally established in 1981 at 3%. 10 years later, in 1991, it increased to 5%. Then in 1995, it was converted from 5% to the approximate equivalent of 75 cents per month. This provided greater revenue stability and predictability. However, it has not been adjusted for inflation, has not changed since 1995. This has turned into a very important public safety issue, especially for rural Oregonians. Let me give you a little, as you go through here, the breakdown, the tax breakdown of the revenues attributed to the counties and the cities. 60% of the revenues distributed straight to the counties or cities with public safety answering points. There are specific guidelines on what that can be spent for, and it has to be in a public safety answering point. 35% of the revenue is withheld by the Office of Emergency Management in what's called the sub-account. The sub-account pays for the equipment and some of the statewide charges, such as trunk lines and telephone lines. 4% has been held in the Department of Revenue for management. 1% goes to the, 4% to the Department of Office of Emergency Management, 1% to the Department of Revenue for administrative costs and programs. A little bit about a little history on the program. Call volume has gone up significantly, 36.8% since 2010, and is projected to increase greatly. Some of the concerns we have with call volume now, if you recall a few weeks ago, there was a major fire in Wilsonville, burned several apartment buildings under construction. An issue that came up to the representative for Wilsonville area was many calls went to their 911 center, their public safety answering point, and they got a busy signal. Some estimates put that night the call volume for that fire action in Wilsonville area was probably at least 1,000 calls went to the 911 center for that single event. So it's a big deal. Call volume is going up, and one thing about it, the more cell phones we have, the more people have the ability to call and they can see more stuff. The surcharge revenue has been fairly flat. In 2014, as you see on here, there was a bump. That was with the addition of burner cell phones, for lack of a better term. It's increased approximately 1.38% since 2010. Statewide expenditures have gone up, and they've increased 2.85% since 2010, with local jurisdiction expenditures increasing by 4.2% for 2010. Increased cost breakdown. Some of the problem that we have is we're trying to, in 1995, when this system was identified, a call would come into a 911 center. Person would get out their clipboard, write down the information that they received, and process the process the action required. Now it's pretty much automated. The call comes in, the dispatcher can see where the call came from, locate it on the map, identify what it is, and then the CAD system will help get to that process. Call taking equipment, hardware, software, and licensing has gone up significantly, and it's increased the capability that they have. Increase the disbursement levels for geographic information system. When they get a call, they know exactly where it is through a database. Call taking workstations, call volume has increased significantly, and call taking workstations need have gone up. And these are pretty sophisticated stations. A call taking workstation can cost as much as $600,000 for an individual station. Many dispatch centers have multiple stations. Increased phone system vendor maintenance cost. We have a statewide centralized procurement for the main trunk line, the switching equipment. And increased 911 call delivery infrastructure cost due to statewide call volume and general inflation costs are all impacts of the breakdown. These are the two numbers. This slide is in front of you. The two numbers that when I started this process, I wanted to flip. It was about 70% of the cost for the 911 centers was borne by the local administrative jurisdiction, whether it be a city, a county, or a taxing district. 30% went to the state funds of the state collected funds. It was my goal to switch those two numbers so it would be 70% by the state funds and 30% by the local jurisdictions. So we arrived at the 75% raise, or 75 cent raise, to doubling the fee. The problem is it didn't quite do all that. So the problems are identified on the left. PSAPs are understaffed, costs increase in 8 to 15% per year. Taxes generally cover less than 25% of the cost. Solutions is to raise the tax from 75 cents to $1.50. This puts it at the new rate at $1.50. It puts a total non-equipment cost of the PSAPs at 62%. So the local jurisdictions will still have to pay 38% of their operational cost. And it put the equipment cost at 75%. One thing this bill does is it decreases the amount of overhead costs that go off. Department of Revenue has a fixed amount of money that they need. When we double the account, we dropped their percentage rate from 1% to 0.5%. We did the same thing for Office of Emergency Management. We went from 4% to 2%. So they maintain flat level funding. All of the increased cost goes directly to the operation of the centers. Here's just another pretty cool pie chart on that. I won't bore you because I know we have a time issue. There's three major components of it: the per capita, the county distribution, and the Office of Emergency Management. Here's what, and I'll talk about the sub account. That's a 35% that goes to OEM for the non. The state-funded issues from the top. 911 sub-account is currently underfunded. The $12.1 million goes to CenturyLink to provide the switching services. Call-taking equipment is $5 million. Call-taking system maintenance, system call matrix data collection, GIS system, UPS system, uninterrupted power supply, and the text to 911. At the current level, at 75 cents, we're $3.5 million in the hole every year. We're getting further behind. This is the needs identified. This would be an annual need. It's about $41 million annual need for the subaccount to fund and maintain the call-taking equipment at its correct lifestyle or life cycle, which is at $41 million, we're still funding 75% of that to come from our sub-account. So we're still not going to fully meet that need, but we're a lot closer than we have been in the past. 911 funding breakdown. On the left, the current breakdown, it's a $45.5 million annual appropriation. It's an annual that it comes in. We just flat double that number. Direct to the PSAP doubles. The 911 sub-account doubles, and the total PSAP operation cost. So when you look at the bottom, the total operation cost for the PSAPs for local funding, state funding, is $145 million. So the first question that we asked when we started looking at this is, how can we consolidate and make a difference? Well, we have gone down. There are currently 42 PSAPs operational in the state. There are some that probably could, and there are studies going on. The Office of Emergency Management and the PSAP study group went a few years ago, crafted a very large effort, did a comprehensive evaluation, and come up with some efficiency programs to come out of that. And they have, in fact, and they are continuing to implement that study, reducing the total number of PSAPs, but it's a slow process. It's a pretty big step to do that. And there's ongoing efforts to execute the rest of that agreement. So, make sure I didn't skip my notes. I could go on and on and talk forever on that, but I know in the interest of time, I'll try not to. Do you have any questions for me?
Senator Hernandez.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Chair. Representative Finley, thank you for presenting on this. Just a question, some more context for me who isn't that knowledgeable on this stuff. Historically, these centers have been funded through local property taxes?
When this 911 was set up, it was meant to fund a good share of that with the balance of this 911 tax paying for it and local jurisdictions paying for the other. And I have to say local jurisdiction because some of these centers are run by counties, some are run by cities, and some are run by a special taxing district. So there needs to be ownership by both. But the workload is significantly increasing, and the impact on the local communities is significant. I'm going to use an example. In Harney County, the sheriff put in his resignation on Friday because the county's in budget crisis, and short of reducing his capability anymore, he said he's not going to ask his deputies to go. You can't cut anything else, so he's going to resign. It is a huge deal. I've had multiple sheriffs and police chiefs and others tell me with this program, it'll increase their capability on the ground. The Malheur County Sheriff said he would add patrol deputies, if this has happened, because it'll free up their local funding to add increased capability on the ground. So, and other sheriffs have told me the same. And so they have to have some ownership to ensure they maintain and reduce costs. But I think this is a statewide system because anytime you're any place, you need to have the same capability when you call. The dispatcher needs to know where you are, what your issue is, and their closest available help for you to deal with it. So, and that's done. There's a lot of efficiencies by centralized procurement of some of these things.
Just follow up, Madam Chair, just quickly. In terms of long-term solution, how long do you foresee this being viable in terms of funding? Is it a long-term structural change that will keep continuing the system and we won't need to come back and fix it later, or what? Is this a temporary fix?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Hernandez, this is an ongoing program. I mean, in a perfect world, we would have set this rate higher to fully fund the sub-accounts and put a inflation index in there so it went up every year. So we wouldn't have to come back and have these discussions. Because quite frankly, for me, a conservative member of my party from the eastern side of the state, to come propose this, it's a pretty big deal. And it was suggested to me that I probably need to have a lobotomy because this isn't what we normally do. But this is a program that needs to be done. This is a statewide program, and it really needs to happen. And yeah, we're going to come back in 10 or 15 years and say we need to look at this number and raise it up again. Because, just because of inflationary. We're not keeping up with equipment purchases. We're much better off. And as technology increases, it just exceeds the capability of local units, whether you're in Portland or you're in Harney County.
Thank you. I don't have a question, but I do want to state for the record, one of my interests to discuss with you at another time is the number of PSAPs we have around the state. I have participated in that discussion in previous years and have some opinions and some ideas about the number of PSAPs that the state needs and can afford to support. But there's no question about the need for this program and this service. I want to let you know that.
Yeah. And Chair Nathanson, I absolutely agree with that. I think that's a valid discussion. And I went back, and when I started this, I was just going to say, well, we need to cut X number. But you look at the work done, and it's been done by a pretty good, well-rounded group that gets to the goal of some further reductions. I would say there's two or three more that need to go away. And it's in the planning stages to probably get there. I'm not going to tell you how many specifically, but that you have a very valid question. But some of the issue, I talked with a person that runs a center to the north of us, and that they don't know how much more volume they can have. If you can combine facilities, they just can't deal with the volume. So,
right. Yes.
It's a great question. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Undoubtedly, we will be talking about this some more. Next, I'd like to hear from Nick Green, who will be joining us through the magic of technology. Nick Green is not in the room. 2 minutes. I'm sorry that we have to limit you. And after Nick, we will hear from Sheriff Jason Myers, Chief Jim Ferraris, and Chief Joe Zaludic.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Marsh, Vice Chair Finley, Representative Hernandez. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
We can.
Nick Green, I'm the city manager for John Day, Oregon. The city of John Day has operated a public safety answering point for Grant County for the past 30 years. So we've got fairly significant experience managing 911 centers basically since their creation as a statewide mandate. In the past 20 years, our costs have risen to operate the PSAP about 2.5 times faster than our state shared revenue. I think our location has done a tremendous job maintaining costs where they can. Our average cost per employee right now is only $76,000 a year, and that's fully burdened. So we run a very efficient PSAP, but revenue has not kept pace with the cost of labor in particular. So due to that, plus declining state tax revenue under the 1% distribution model, we're trying to operate today on the same tax receipts from the state that we had 10 years ago. So in the period, we were actually chasing declining state tax revenue. So we are one of the smallest PSAPs, but I can explain to you how we fund the difference. We basically take our property tax receipts and put 100% of that every year into public safety. Right now, our cost just to maintain the minimum number of staff required to answer calls 24 hours a day is about 22% of our property tax base. It's the value of one law enforcement officer every year that we're giving up. And that's how we cover the gap. So it is a very significant cost. It has a very real impact on us. This is a de minimis tax, and I would just encourage you to give it your due consideration. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Thanks for making that possible. Go ahead.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm the Marion County Sheriff, and I'm here today representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the 36 sheriffs in Oregon who support House Bill 2449. I think it's been articulated very well, the need for this. The only thing I would add is that over the 20 plus years that this tax hasn't been increased, that the cost, the burden at the local level has been paid in the form of user fees by police and fire and EMS agencies. And just as an example, for my organization, my increase yearly is about a deputy position. It's a roughly $80,000 a year increase. For my organization, I'm much larger. I'm 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year coverage. But as you go east, one deputy position can be the difference between having 24-hour coverage and not having 24-hour coverage. So this this increase will support the infrastructure of our 911 system as well as our the burden at the local level, and any savings actually equates to more public safety responders. So you have a good 911 system that takes the calls, and then you actually have somebody on the other end that can respond. Thank you very much. We are in support of this bill.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Ferraris. I'm the chief of police in Woodburn. I'm also the vice president of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I serve as the chair of the governing board of METCOM, which is the Marion Area Multi-Agency Emergency Telecommunications Center. It's a mouthful. That's why we call it METCOM, which provides 911 and dispatch services to more than 29 agencies, police, fire, and emergency medical, not only in Marion County, but throughout the Willamette Valley. The OACP strongly supports the passage of House Bill 2449A. That said, we don't take our recommendation lightly. No one wants to see tax increases, particularly at this time in our being, but we're at a critical stage in Oregon with regard to funding 911 operations, as you've heard. But I want to emphasize, this is a statewide issue. This just isn't an issue for Woodburn, for Marion County, for Willamette Valley. This extends throughout the state of Oregon. Local law enforcement leaders were keenly aware that funding from 911 excise taxes has declined for several years, as you've heard this morning. That leaves an increasing financial burden on local governments, including organizations like mine, like the sheriffs, like the fire chiefs, to maintain 911 operations. Regrettably, that declining 911 excise tax revenue is forcing us as public safety leaders across the state to divert those scarce dollars for public safety resources from our first responders, like you heard, to underwrite that funding gap at our 911 centers. For instance, in my organization for the upcoming fiscal year, my increase for METCOM for the services I pay for on behalf of my organization have increased $50,000. That's one half salary for a police officer. So now I have to look within my budget and make cuts in service to my community to fill that gap. Because Oregon's PSAPs or 911 centers are the critical lifeline between our communities and our public safety organizations, we need to do all we can to keep this intact. We support this bill, and we hope you do too. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, Revenue Committee. My name is Joe Zludek. I'm the fire chief for Eugene Springfield Fire. First, to speak to the need. With no action this legislative session, our city's PSAP will be in deficit beginning in FY21, $500,000 a year, with an estimate of a $7 million deficit by the year 2030. This assumes current staffing levels, and we know that our calls for service are increasing, and we presently are not staffed where we need to be going into the near future. We know that we're keeping vacancies open as we speak to try to cover our costs, and we've been doing that as a funding strategy, which is not an effective way to answer our calls for service. Presently, the Central Lane Communication Service is actively working to upgrade their CAD. The CAD installed in just 2013 is not meeting the needs of our community. We cannot even use IP alerting, which can deal with the metro and the rural IP alerting at the same time. To put it in perspective, we're still using the tones that you used to hear on emergency when Johnny and Roy would respond in the 70s. This is 40 going on 50 year technology that we're trying to upgrade to an internet protocol that we do not yet have the capacity to do that. This is the funding that will actively help us to get into the modern era and save 20 to 30 seconds while those tones are going off to improve 36,000 calls for service a year in our region. As for the comparison, I've seen some of the data from the wireless community that says that we're trying to speak to Washington, California, and Idaho on how this tax is similar. It really is very dissimilar. When you look at the potential for sales tax at point of purchase, this makes the Oregon tax a much better value than they have over the life cycle of that handpiece or that cell phone. for transparency. Eugene does a great job, and they do annual reports to make sure that they can see how these funds are spent on a routine basis. And we use all the 911 PSAP fees for the operation of the CLCC. Thank you very much, and we definitely support House Bill 2449. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. Next will be Richard Kosasen, Drew Hagedorn, Kelsey Wilson, and after that, let's see, Hasina Wittenberg, Marge Mullen, and Jeff Rasmussen. Please begin. Just let's get started. Thank you. Whoever's seated first should start first.
I think Mr. Kosasen is coming. Thank you, Chair Nathanson, committee members. I'm Drew Hagedorn, appearing today on behalf of T-Mobile, testifying in opposition to the bill as it's currently composed. And I want to underscore the fact for the committee today and for the audience that we really respect and appreciate all the work that's gone into this legislation that Representative Finley has led, and all the work that the folks seated behind us do to keep Oregonians safe. And indeed, the wireless sector has long been a supporter of the E911 program. We've worked on legislation to increase this tax over the years. It's often been difficult, as it was when we had a first-in-the-nation point-of-sale prepaid wireless tax that was applied. We've also worked with the legislature and others to be your tax collectors. So we collect these taxes and then remit them to DOR from our customers. So I want to underscore that we do care very much about the program, and I understand why, if you were an advocate exclusively for E911, you'd want to double the tax, 75 cents, to get to all the unmet needs. But from where we sit, we have to balance the needs of the E911 system with the needs of our customers, and this is a significant regressive and new tax that they'll be asked to pay. I want to also underscore that it's a per-line tax, so each phone number is assessed as tax. And I'll use myself as an example. We have 6 wireless devices in our household, plus 2 iPads that are connected and have their own phone numbers. So we're paying the tax 8 times over each time as a family. And we may be a little bit unique having that many lines, but many Oregonians, because this product is so ubiquitous and people need to have it in their daily lives, have more than one device, and they use that for a variety of reasons in the workplace or to keep track of their children. All I'm going to let Mr. Kosasen talk a little bit more about the data, and if I may, Madam Chair, really quickly, in the work group that took place in the Emergency Preparedness Committee, we came forward and worked on a proposal to increase the tax by 50 cents over a period of time. So we could have supported doing 25 cents in 2020 and then another 25 cents in 2021. That roughly keeps us up with the rate of inflation. And Mr. Kosasen will talk a little bit more about inflation and the proliferation of phones and some of the data around that. And then lastly, I would just ask the committee maybe to slow down slightly and give us the opportunity, now that we're domiciled in a committee that's not subject to the deadlines, to work on something that the industry can support, because we do care about the program. We want to see something pass, but we want something that's workable for our customers. And thank you for letting me run over. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
You're out of payback another time. We'll shorten another testimony.
Fair enough.
Good morning. Richard Kosasen on behalf of Verizon Wireless. Just a few minutes ago, there was some information provided that showed cost increases ranging from 8 to 15%. If that truly was the case, then total costs would double between a period of about 5 and 9 years. So, in essence, I think to a previous question, is an increase sustainable? No, I think you face an increase year after year after year after year if the funding is absolutely essential. But in terms of just some dollars and cents, 75 cents currently charged per line is a little bit lower than the national average. National average ranges from about 87 cents to 91 cents per month. If you would take a look at the 75-cent charge in 1995, and in adjust for inflation, you would be about $1.20, $1.25 today. That's about a 60-65% increase. But at the same time, your receipts, because of the proliferation of the number of phones in the state, your receipts have gone up nearly 200%. If you look then in fiscal year 96, you were assessing the 75-cent charge on less than 2 million phones. In today's marketplace, you have about 4.1 plus million wireless phones. You have, that's me, I'm done. You have about 600,000 switched access lines. Your growing field is in your voice over internet protocol. Time's up, thank you.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelsey Wilson and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Cable and Telecommunications Association. OCTA is comprised of cable operators in the state of Oregon who offer voice over internet protocol or VoIP phone services. In the interest of time, I'll echo many of the comments from my wireless colleagues. OCTA has concerns over the doubling of the 911 tax, both because of the dramatic increase in the tax and because this tax is only one of several taxes on VoIP being considered this session. We appreciated the opportunity to engage with stakeholders on House Bill 2449 when the bill was in the House Veterans Affairs Committee. We believe, however, that additional conversations about the need for doubling of the tax are warranted. Clearly, 911 is an extremely important program that our members support. We understand the potential need for additional funding and engaged in the workgroup discussion in hopes that we could reach a more reasonable path forward on increasing the tax. Unfortunately, the proposal before you today looks fairly similar to the bill as drafted before the workgroup discussions occurred. OCTA supports the effort to require interest from the 911 fund staying in the 911 fund. We do not believe money collected for the 911 account should be diverted for any purpose, and we believe the interest from that money should go to pay for the 911 services. We welcome continued discussions about the justification for an increase in the 911 tax, but urge the committee to consider a scaled-back increase that takes into account other taxes that may occur related to telecommunications this session. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Okay, let's hear from the next panel. Hasina, Margie, Jeff, and after that, Mark Buchholz, Carl Koenig, Mark Spross.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hasina Wittenberg, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon APCO NENA chapters. We represent the public safety answering points statewide. As you've heard, there are 43 public safety answering points statewide. And to your point, Representative Nathanson, there has been a lot of consolidation related to PSAPs. There were 280 originally, and we're down to 43. So not quite one per county, but getting very close to that. We are here in support of House Bill 2449. The bill would double the tax, but it also does another very important function, which extends the existing sunset on the tax to 1-1 of 2030. This tax is scheduled to sunset next legislative session if it's not reauthorized, which is something that's very important to the 911 community. I'd like to spend the rest of my testimony addressing a letter from CTIA, the Cellular Telecommunications Industry Association, and their opposition letter indicates that they would like to see more transparent and accountable oversight of these funds. And I just it would be a terrible thing if this committee thought that these funds were not highly regulated. Current statute, ORS 403-245, clearly articulates and outlines what those funds can be spent for. They cannot be spent for dispatching. They are spent for call-taking purposes. Actually, a call taker answering the phone, getting that call transferred so it can be properly dealt with. In addition, all of these PSAPs are all governed by either a city, county, or a special district, and they all have user boards. And the user boards are very, very involved in the expenditures of those dollars, as you heard from Sheriff Myers, when the property tax revenues are used for 911 call-taking functions. The users are paying those fees, so private sector ambulance, public safety, police departments, and fire departments are making up the cost of that. So there's quite a bit of transparency going on within the 911 program. In addition, Office of Emergency Management has an entire website dedicated, portion of their page to exactly where the money is going and what it is being used for. So we would just urge your support of this legislation.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Marsh, and members of the committee. My name is Margie Mullen, and I'm the Director of Emergency Communications of Southern Oregon. We're the 911 and dispatch center in Jackson County, covering all of Jackson County, and we're a consolidated center covering Jackson County and Crater Lake National Park. I'm here in support of this bill. Our agency is in support of this bill, and all of our public safety users that subscribe for our services are in support of this bill as well. We serve 29 police, fire, and EMS agencies in Jackson County and Crater Lake, and we are an ORS 190. So I have an intergovernmental board that I answer to and my board of directors that I answer to. Our users subscribe for our services and support us 84% in our current budget. So there's only 16% currently of our budget that is covered by the 911 tax. That's certainly not sufficient, and it's causing problems for all of our users, our public safety agencies, that have to have a deficit in their own budget to cover our needs. In this next budget year, we're projecting that we'll only have 14% of our budget covered by the 911 tax, and the rest of it covered by all of our users. I began my career in 1991, and at that time, we wrote everything on pieces of paper and handed it to the next person so that it could be dispatched. So as I would take a call from a 911 caller, I would write that information down in a spiral notebook, and then I would transfer it to a card, and I would hand it over. Since then, obviously, the costs of running a 911 center have increased dramatically, because now we use computerized systems. We have shaved minutes off of our response times by doing that, getting the information to our users much more quickly. It may have been much cheaper to write things down on paper and pass it along, but it certainly wasn't efficient and didn't get the help to our citizens the way it needed to. So costs have dramatically increased, and that's why I'm asking for your support of this particular bill. In addition to that, we're doing what we can to save the money we need for all of the equipment that we need statewide at the state level, and because of that, they have had to limit what they are spending at the local level, and because of that, with some changes in OAR, it's becoming even more and more incumbent on the locals to support what we need just to stay with the equipment we currently have, not even including adding anything else. So thank you for your time, and I know that my time is up, so I appreciate being here.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Jeff Rasmussen. I'm the County Administrative Officer in Jefferson County, Oregon, here on behalf of the Board of County Commissioners and the Association of Oregon Counties in support of the bill. Just want to go over just some quickly. The 911 tax, you know, is not increased. Right now, the Tax Foundation, org, which is attached to my testimony, has Oregon ranked as the least taxed in the state when it comes to 911. And we will continue to stay there unless some action is taken. If you do double it, that'll raise us to 48th least taxed in the nation. Industry doesn't like to use the industry tax or the Tax Foundation report unless they're in a high tax state. They used the same report in Washington last year to indicate how overtaxed the state of Washington is. In their testimony, they have us going up only using the fee as your marker instead of using sales tax as well. Our other states that don't have a sales tax, Alaska, Delaware, Montana, and New Hampshire, have excise tax that the industry doesn't like to count in the testimony today. Overall, we are in desperate need. If our infrastructure for 911 was failing, and we were 50th when it came, when we were talking about roads, there would be no question that we needed a fuel tax increase. This is the same thing. We're in desperate need. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The next group was Mark and Carl. And after that, we'll hear from Jennifer Reese, Mike Fletcher, Bob Kazi.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Spross. I'm the executive director for METCOM 911, which serves Marion, parts of Clackamas, and parts of Linn County. I really appreciate your time here. My colleagues are going through the needs. I'm going to just jump straight to it. 911 is calling for your help. We need your help. I know that you guys have a lot of different tax measures that will be before you today, but this is, or I'm sorry, through this session, but this has been pushed off for years and years and years. Industry talks about they're supportive of the tax, but they want to slow down. We've been here before, and they fought against it. That's why we're at a doubling of the tax. Please look at all the facts in front of you. They'll tell you that we've not justified it. Oregon Emergency Management has brought forward, and Representative Finley has brought forward, we're in a deficit today. We're walking towards a cliff. We're about to start running towards that cliff. And it's going to be a direct impact on the services we can provide to the citizens in Oregon. We need your leadership. We need you to help us fix this problem. I know that you have a lot of competition out there for the tax dollars, but I would beg of you, ask your constituents. No one is going to say they want to raise on the tax, but please tell them what it's for. When they say that they've got 15 phone lines in their house, 20 years ago, we didn't have 15 different phone lines for people to call 911. Each one of those devices, they expect to be able to reach us in 911, whether they call us, whether they text us, many number of ways to try and get a hold of us. We can't keep up with the technology. My phone equipment today is 10 times more expensive than it was 20 years ago, and yet I still have to put that equipment in our center in order to staff and in order to answer calls for service. I just ask that you please, please look at this closely, independently from all the other tax measures, and understand that we have a big need today, and look in the room. You have people from all over the state of Oregon. This isn't just one section, this is the entire state, and we need your leadership. Please help us. 911 is calling for your help. I'm begging that you answer that call, and please help fund the system. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, co-chairs Finley and Marsh, members of the Revenue Committee. I'm Carl Koenig, president of the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and a proud consumer of the other side of 911. You call it to get help. I would happen to be that person that comes to your aid when you call. As an example, every shift I work in Clackamas County for Clackamas County Fire, my employer responds to approximately 100 calls a day. And as Mark, my colleague, former colleague at CECOM, can attest, those 100 calls a day may generate 10 to 15 calls apiece to our 911 center. This is indeed, and that doesn't even count in law enforcement, that's just on the fire side. So fire and medical, each one of those calls for help may generate up to 15 calls. I'm here testifying in support of House Bill 2449A and the increase in the 911 tax. Just a fun fact, as was just stated, we're 50th in cell phone taxation and assessed on consumers, and this will keep Oregon still near the bottom as it relates. As a cell phone consumer, just as a comparison, I pay $1.50 a month on my phone. So there's a tax fairness here also for the regular market and the prepaid. The pressure on 911 centers and their users is a well-told story of success. I think we've done a great job at marketing 911. Some say we might be too good at it. But in fact, it's still a cost. It's a cost to society. And we need to make sure that everybody helps pay for that. Adding staff to answer the call and getting help to call costs money, and the equitable tax to fund 911 centers across the state is a correct way to guarantee that service stays viable for all Oregonians and visitors as well. Your career 3,500 firefighters and paramedics urge a yes vote on 2449 to serve both sides of the 911 calls for years to come. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Finley, Marsh, and Representative Hernandez. My name is Mark Buchholz. I'm the director of the Willamette Valley 911 Center, which serves here in Salem and a fair portion of Lincoln County, all of Polk County, and a chunk of Marion County. I'm here today on behalf of our 911 Center, which is run by the Salem Police Department, and we contract for all of that service with all of those agencies. I saw how fast 2 minutes will go, so I'm going to try to skip through and hit the highlights here. I'm speaking on behalf of our member agencies, Chief Gerald F. Morris, Salem Police Chief, and myself. We serve the three counties, as I mentioned. We handle about 170,000 911 calls a year. Over the past 20 years, our cost increases have been roughly 4 to 4.1%. Over 20 years, that equals 80% increase. The key, the 911 tax has not increased at all. Therefore, as you heard earlier from our public safety partners, the general funds of all of our departments, police, sheriff, and fire departments, are picking up the slack. Today, we are funding 81% of our 911 operation through the general fund of all of those departments, and the 911 tax is only covering 19% of our operation. We support the increase to $1.50. I realize that that is seems like a large increase, but realizing it's only covering 19% of our operation, it's a wonderful addition. It would be very helpful, but it really isn't enough. So we appreciate your support. We recommend strongly that you pass the bill as amended. Thank you.
We will hear from Jennifer, Mike, and Bob, and after that, Jim McCauley, if there are things that haven't been said yet. We need to move very quickly through this last panel, because immediately following this, we will have a public hearing on House Bill 2269.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and the representatives of the committee. My name is Jennifer Reese. I'm the Assistant Director with Washington County Communications, and also known as WACA. We're a consolidated communications agency. We serve Washington County, about 589,000 citizens in Washington County. We also extend into Multnomah County, areas of Yamhill County and Clackamas County. We're here in support of the increase in the 911 tax. Currently, the excise tax covers about 20% of our costs, and the majority and lion's share of the remainder of the cost is borne by our users. We dispatch for 18 police and fire agencies, and our calls, we process approximately 500,000 calls a year. Of those, about 200,000 of those are 911 calls. So our population, our demand for service has increased, as the others have said, since 1995. And this has caused a real problem with the 911 tax not increasing in the increased cost to our center. So we would ask that you pass this bill as amended, and we are in total support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and fellow committee members. My name is Mike Fletcher. I'm the director of Columbia 911 Communications Center. I'm also the vice president for Oregon APCO NENA. Last week, I sent a letter of support for this bill that showed some comparisons, cost of living from 1995 to today. It's an interesting thing, and I think it plays well with the thought that I am making an assumption that everybody in this room has a career outside of the halls of justice here. And if you do have a career, perhaps making something, providing a service, farming, whatever it is, you're compensated for that. However, if you spent the last 25 years with no cost of living, no merit increase, no bonus, not even any kind of adjustments at all, I would like to welcome you to our club. That is Oregon 911. About a year ago, OEM started a conversation with the 911 managers of the state regarding the deficits that we have in our funds. And I'm not sure if you're aware of the impacts that those deficits are causing us in our industry. We're actually reducing services, we're reducing capability of our equipment. The state has defunded certain workstations in all of our centers at this table. So we don't even have the people now to place at a workstation because the workstation will be defunded. Our backup switches to allow us the ability, should we need to evacuate our centers and go to a backup center or have our 911 calls roll to another center, has been defunded. The state has identified 18 other targets of either decreased funding or elimination. The calls to 911 aren't to the Butterball hotline. These are people calling for help, and we're asking for your help at this time. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and members of the House Revenue Committee. I'm Bob Causey, a director of Portland Bureau of Emergency Communications. We're also known as Portland 911. We're a consolidated center that provides 911 service for all of Multnomah County. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2449A and hope to provide information on how this bill can positively impact 911 services throughout the state if enacted. Currently, about 11% of my agency's costs are covered by the 911 tax. Over the past 10 years, staffing costs, not including overtime, have risen by 22%. Over the past 10 years, our Bureau's overall call load has increased 31%. And in 2018, we processed over a million calls. Text to 911 capabilities were implemented at my agency in August of 2016. And last year alone, we processed 1,463 texts that resulted in over 9,000 individual messages sent to callers from our staff in order to process those calls. Although all costs associated with operating a 911 center have increased substantially over the years, there's been no associated increase in funding to support those needs. Although this is an issue that we seek to help resolve by this House bill, there is an additional issue that this House bill will address that is vitally important, not just to 911 centers across our state, but also to callers in need of 911 services. The issue is technology. We live in a period in which mobile phones, texting, sending videos is the norm. Many people do not understand why their pizza driver can find them when 911 can't. Although it's a great advancement to have text to 911, this technology is not integrated into a call answering platform. This matters because, as we mentioned before, we've sent over 9,000 text messages, and each one can result in a call for service. Each of these scenarios above could better be solved through adequate funding of the 911 system in the state of Oregon, and I urge your support of House Bill 2449A. Thank you.
Thank you. Jim? This will be our last speaker on this bill.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Morris and Finley, Jim McCauley representing League of Oregon Cities. I'm not sure if there's much I can possibly add other than I think the recognition of the people who have come here today from across the state advocating for the importance of 911 services and the inadequacy of the current funding stream. It's certainly a critical component of where our cities and our public emergency systems need to have some an infusion of some infrastructure, and it's pretty clear from OEM and what they've offered in terms of the project costs and the type of upgrades that are going to be taking place over the next several years that the 75 cents is critically needed. I'll close my comments with that because honestly there's nothing much more I can add other than this is really very much a critical need, demonstrated need, and we're happy to support it.
And thank you for delivering the succinct message. That concludes the testimony on this bill. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2449. I'm opening the public hearing on House Bill 2269A. And after we hear a very brief introduction, we will be taking testimony at no more than 2 minutes each for this public hearing also. Go ahead and start.
Okay, great. Okay. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, a very brief background on House Bill 2269A. The provisions in this bill require non-exempt employers of 50 or more employees to contribute to their employees' health care costs and gives them a few options for doing so. The bill comes to us from the House Committee on Health Care, and I think I'll leave it at that given
okay.
the time constraint.
Thank you very much. First, we will hear from Patrick Allen and Cameron Smith.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. Patrick Allen, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. House Bill 2269 is the result of an assignment given to the Health Authority by the Governor's Work Group on financing the Oregon Health Plan. It's one of the four components that the Governor proposed as part of her financing package. You've already considered some of those components. This is one of the two that remain. And really, it's aimed at not only providing funding for the health plan, but addressing the 250,000 Oregonians who are ineligible or not offered health care through their work or the and the additional 150,000 who are not able to take advantage of that health care. In short, what House Bill 2269 is a spending requirement. It says for any employee that works more than 8 hours in a week for more than 90 days in a calendar, an employer has to spend 50 cents an hour on their health care. That can take any number of forms. It can be in terms of health insurance, contribution to a health savings account, paying for procedures for that matter. But if none of those are taken, then the option is to pay into the health care access fund. That health care access fund would in turn either provide funding to the Oregon Health Plan, if that's where their employees are getting their health coverage, or go to DCBS to contribute to reductions in cost of insurance on the individual marketplace. The requirement is waivable by the employee. And aims to really try to figure out a way to try to deal with this ongoing cost of health care for people who are working but aren't able to access health insurance in that fashion. Cameron?
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And we come to this health policy work through our role as the insurance commissioner and also from overseeing the Oregon health insurance marketplace. I want to thank Governor Brown, OHA, and Director Allen, and all of you. Through our shared efforts, together, 94% of Oregonians now have health coverage. We are fortunate to have a bipartisan approach to sustainably fund and expand both the Oregon Health Plan and invest in the Oregon Reinsurance Program and Marketplace. Okay. While we've made significant progress, we still have over 245,000 Oregonians without health coverage, and we know that for those that do have coverage, high costs for premiums and out-of-pocket costs continue to be a challenge for them to access and use their health care. House Bill 2269 is another avenue for you as policymakers to consider to sustainably fund the Oregon Health Plan and help cover health care costs for eligible Oregonians. There's still many policy and program details to consider, but want to walk through a quick high-level picture of the agency roles. The Oregon Department of Employment and Department of Revenue would be essential to identify affected employers and play a key role in the data tracking and sharing through the combined payroll system. Treasury would establish the Health Care Access Fund. DCBS, through our Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace, would design and implement a state-funded financial assistance program for those employers. For those employees whose employers pay into the fund, and OHA through its health policy board would set the health care expenditure rate and receive any funds not used for financial assistance. Bureau of Labor and Industries would also have a notification and compliance role as well. This would be a significant new program for DCBS. It would be a large benefit program and a claims processing role for us. In the individual insurance products on the marketplace today, they take advantage of the federal exchange, as well as the federal tax credits for premium subsidies. We do have experience with a small premium assistance program today for the Compact of Free Association Pacific Islanders. We're happy to take any questions.
Thank you.
Very quick question.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Allen, I've read this bill. We talked earlier this morning, but, mm-hmm. and you talked this morning about a 50 cent per hour charge. I can't find that number in the bill, and all I find is it gives agency full discretion with no cap.
Yeah, Chair Nathanson, Representative Finley, it's correct. As Director Smith said, the Health Policy Board establishes the spending requirement, and so the requirement isn't in the, or the actual level isn't in the statute. 50 cents is what we've modeled and been using and what we would expect to establish that at.
Quick follow-up and I'll be done, I promise.
Mm-hmm. And the response will need to be quick.
But at issue is all of the rules and everything, there's no legislative oversight in any of what you're saying, which gives me grave concerns.
Aside from the budget process.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we will hear from John Calhoun.
Jen Hauser.
And Felisa Hagen. You can just start as soon as you can.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Marsh, Finley, members of the committee. My name is John Calhoun. I'm speaking today on behalf of Tax Fairness Oregon. In spite of the passage of the ACA and increases in Medicaid, the vast majority of working citizens get their health care through business. When employers do not provide health care to their employees, they're gaming the system and pushing the costs off on the rest of society. I spent over 25 years starting and growing businesses as an entrepreneur and investor. Not once did I consider it appropriate to have a business that did not provide basic health care coverage. It was just fundamental ethical judgment. Since I needed health care, I could not justify not providing health care for my employees. It is even more unethical for medium or large businesses to fail to provide insurance, since many of them do this by keeping hours under the 30-hour federal threshold. They impoverish their employees two ways, by not providing full-time employment and not providing health care. Since large multinational firms operate in other countries and cannot escape the taxes that pay for healthcare in those countries, we must stop them from getting away with it here in Oregon. These companies compete unfairly against employers that do provide insurance. Those employers now pay a 2% surcharge tax on their healthcare premiums to help cover the cost of Oregon's Medicaid program. Employers that provide no healthcare should also contribute to the Oregon program, since it is their employees that are getting the benefit. The vast majority of the businesses affected are not in traded sectors, so the claim they cannot pay for insurance for competitive reasons doesn't fly. It is long past time that employers need to step up and fulfill their obligations to their employees and to the general public. We urge you to pass this bill.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Findlay and Marsh, and members of the committee. My name is Jim Hauser, and my wife and I own and operate Hawthorne Auto Clinic in Southeast Portland. I also serve on the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace Advisory Committee, and I'm co-chair of the Main Street Alliance of Oregon. Currently, Hawthorne Auto Clinic has 10 full-time staff. For all of our 36 years, our company has provided full family health insurance coverage for our employees and their dependents. Health insurance is expensive, but so is the cost of recruiting and training replacement staff to competently repair late model high-tech automobiles. As I have learned over the years, you don't want your best customers to even think of going anywhere else. The same holds true for your capable, loyal employees. The trouble for companies like mine that provide good benefits is that we are at a competitive disadvantage with mostly larger companies with larger marketing and other resources, but not providing healthcare support, like the companies addressed with this bill. Additionally, when their employees require medical attention they can't afford and don't have medical coverage, the rest of us end up paying for it, whether in a public program or uncompensated care, and the higher insurance rates that come with that cost. This bill, HB 2269A, levels the playing field for smaller businesses and for other businesses that are doing the right thing by covering the premiums for their staff. Oregon is a small business state. Nationally, 95% of businesses have fewer than 50 employees. Small businesses aren't directly affected by this bill. The bill preserves choice for small businesses. I know that is important in the small business community to keep the most flexibility, the choice of whether or not to support employee health care for small businesses. This bill does that. Overall, the bill is a good balance between flexibility for small businesses and fairness among all businesses. Thank you for your time and attention. I would be happy to answer any questions.
For the record, my name is Felisa Higgins. I'm the political director at SEIU Local 49. I'm also a former member of the Oregon Health Policy, and I was on the governor's work group to fund Medicaid. So I want to start out by saying, just reminding us of our overarching goal as a state, is that our goal was to have affordable, accessible, quality health care for all Oregonians, and that means all Oregonians. Currently, we're at 95%, which is great, and we've done a lot of work to get there. However, as Cameron mentioned from DCBS, healthcare is still unaffordable or unreachable for many Oregonians. Today, I'd like to talk about some of our largest employers in the state who still have a large group of workers who are not provided healthcare or don't meet the healthcare requirements of their employers who actually do provide healthcare. Oregon's hospitals are one of the largest employers in our state, and yet many of the workers who work there either have healthcare that is unaffordable to them because they have high deductibles and high copays, or they are what are often called per diem workers, where they don't reach the level of hours where the employer offers healthcare. So often they or their dependents are on the Oregon Health Plan. hospitals benefit in two ways from having workers on the Oregon Health Plan. One way is that they provide, are one of the major providers of the Oregon Health Plan, so they get reimbursed by the Oregon Health Plan. The other way is it is providing health care for their employees. In Washington State, you can see from the testimony that I've submitted, the they report by employer who is on the Oregon Health Plan, and so you can see the charts below. We believe that House Bill 2269 is a good bill because it does exactly what we set out to do as Oregonians. It helps to provide affordable, accessible, quality health care to all Oregonians, and everybody should be contributing to that. With that, you have my written testimony, and I'm wrap up and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. For Mr. Hauser and anyone else, if you have written remarks and haven't given them to us yet, if you could please make arrangements to get them to our committee, we can post them online. Thank you. Next, we will hear from Amanda Dalton, Jenny Dressler, and Paloma Sparks. After that, it will be Josh Ballack and Marcia Kelly.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. Amanda Dalton, I'm here this morning on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association. The bill before you will do nothing to make healthcare more affordable for working Oregonians. It penalizes employers, many of whom are currently offering employer health insurance for choices employees make. I can offer my employer health insurance plan, but I can't mandate my employee signs up for that plan. As you've heard, most of our private plans available don't allow us to cover employees working less than 20 or 17 hours, as you'll see in the underwriter's testimony on OLIS. Fundamentally, HB 2269A changes the benchmark for employer-provided health insurance. It isn't about providing insurance to employees who work 30 hours a week anymore. This concept seeks to reset the benchmark to all employees who average at least 8 hours a week, and only applies to your private employers with 50 or more, not your public employers. HB 2269 also goes far beyond what was discussed in the governor's interim provider package work group to fund the Medicaid hole, of which no employer is targeted by this fee sat. Nevertheless, the bill before you isn't about $119 million anymore. It's now about $449 or even $517 million. So here we are with language that doesn't reflect at all what you have just heard from OHA or that are reflected in the online written materials from them describing the intent. As Rep. Finley noted, you won't find 50 cents in the House Bill 2269 or even in the dash fours because nowhere in the bill or the amendment will you see any mention of this. The Portland Business Journal reported last week that this bill is about requiring employers to spend at least $1,040 a year for health care for full-time employees and $520 for part-time workers. But again, you won't see that in the bill or the dash fours. In fact, there is no specific fee or target amount to raise at all in the bill or the amendment. It simply gives the authority to establish a methodology for assessing employers to the Oregon Health Policy Board. This bill gives the Oregon Health Policy Board more than a blank check. It gives them a blank checkbook. It does this by allowing them to redefine covered employees, determine a methodology for calculating this assessment, and appears to allow this process to be driven by the amount of revenue needed, meaning you may need $119 million today, but next year you may need another $400 million, and this board could simply adjust the methodology without a single vote of this legislative body and reassess Oregon employers.
Good morning. For the record, Paloma Sparks here for Oregon Business and Industry, representing over 1,600 businesses that employ over 300,000 people. While we appreciate the thoughts about making sure that the employers are providing insurance, that's not what this bill does. This bill imposes a 50-cent fee on all employers who then must pay down whether or not they have to pay a fee by proving that they are providing insurance equivalent to whatever the amount is that the Health Policy Board sets. So every employer would have a serious record-keeping requirement and burden imposed upon them. They would have to track now employees down working 8 hours a week. It is incredibly difficult for employers to get insurance for employees at less than 17.5 hours a week. So those are our primary concerns. We also want to ensure that our employees have access to health insurance, and we offer it, and sometimes they turn it down. That's an employee's choice. That's not the employer's choice, but the employer under this scenario would have to pay this fee. And it doesn't take into account all the other benefits that employers are providing. It's looking at sort of the benefit package in this one isolated case without looking at the full option of what we provide. As written, We only got a chance to look at the A4 amendments very briefly over the weekend. I haven't had a chance to share it with very many people, but I have grave concerns about, one, it not identifying how this will work, how employers will comply, what the fee will be, but also BOLI enforcement, which as written appears to make this a wage, that the health insurance payments would now be considered wages under ORS Chapter 653. That gives us significant heartburn.
Thank you. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Chamber of Commerce and Oregon Farm Bureau Federation in opposition to House Bill 2269 as amended. 50 employee businesses are still considered small businesses, and many employers can't afford to do what this bill asks of them. And in many cases, it penalizes them for circumstances that are out of their control. As you'll see in the base bill, there aren't a lot of details, and it's still too light on the details to give us any level of comfort. On page 3 of the amended version, lines 14 through 16, why would the bill limit a business's ability to recoup costs? And why would the state have any purview over business pricing in that section? Wanted to dive into some specific Farm Bureau concerns. First, how does this treat employees who work for several farms for one season? They may work 8 hours at different farms throughout a different season per week. How does it address a situation where an employee has multiple employers? Second, we have questions about how the number of employees are calculated when an employer is both a primary and a secondary employer in terms of farm labor contracting or any sort of temporary staffing situation. Many farms have permanent staff but also rely on farm labor contractors for harvest. How is this counted towards that employer in terms of reaching their 50 employee threshold? And which quarter is being used to determine employee count for that purpose? Third, the bill offers no language to show how this is actually going to work for agriculture. We don't know what the weather will bring, what crops we're going to grow, how many employees are going to be needed, or when and what quarters they're going to be needed in. It's effectively a head tax that presumes that employers are in the wrong before they're able to show that they're good actors. And fourth, and most significant, this bill penalizes employers for circumstances that are out of their control. It is unclear whether workers whose documentation status may be pending or unknown would be eligible for an employer-offered health plan, but they cannot participate in the individual marketplace. And we can't ask those employees where they go for their insurance. So House Bill 2269 is asking employers, many of whom cannot afford insurance themselves, to pay for health care for all of their employees, and then penalizes them when workers by law cannot enroll, even if they want to offer it. As a final point, we've taken a lot of steps this session to protect Oregonians' privacy, but those efforts don't really translate in the bill. And back to the legal status question, we've brought this forward and engaged in a conversation with Department of Revenue and others about how to protect confidentiality in terms of employee information. And that's an important question and concern going forward. So I'll submit the rest. Thank you.
Thank you. And Marcia, and after that, we will hear from Lou Ogden, Kathy Godinez, and Doug Barber.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Ballack, representing All Care Health. We are a Southern Oregon CCO representing Jackson, Josephine, and Curry counties. And I wanted to talk a little bit just about what this funding is actually going to end up going into. In Josephine County alone, we have 36% of our population is on Medicaid, 15% which are there because of the ACA or the expansion population, which means this is really helping the people who are just above the poverty line. And it really does help working families, working, you know, that are out and engaged. And in a lot of cases, you've got small employers who want to be able to do health insurance, but really are disincentivized to get involved inside of it because they look down the street and they see large employers who aren't providing it, and it becomes a competitive disadvantage. So as a result, I think you're seeing a lot of small businesses opt out from actually providing health care because it's just financially not stable. But either way, then the good thing about this is the funding actually goes into OHP, which then is used to make sure these folks are getting health insurance, which is really the most important piece of this entire thing. We've proven through the CCO concept, upstream preventative health care results in lower costs for everybody over the long term. I do want to kind of point out, though, just a little bit of going back in time. Back in 2007, when Ben Westlin and Alan Bates were trying to create the Oregon Health, or basically what CCOs are today, they did 26 town halls in 36 days all across the state, and I actually was part of a lot of those. And what we saw every single time were business owners who came in and would say, hey, I want to provide health insurance, but there's a competitive disadvantage for me to do that. What are we going to do? And back then, they actually proposed something very similar to this. Because of a lot of different pieces that were going on, Affordable Care Act passed and stuff, it didn't really get instituted. But these concerns are still out there, and I do fundamentally believe that this could help address that disincentive for providing health insurance. So thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Marsh, and Findlay, and members of the committee, Marsha Kelly for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. We are in support of this bill. We think it's a reasonable approach to those employers who could afford to pay some toward employees' health care. I know I would have appreciated this when I was a small business owner. Just looking at the figures, if someone is at minimum wage, even working full-time, and the company has 50 employees, the total employee compensation without health care is $1.4 million for 40 hours a week at $12.50. That's the highest minimum wage in the state of Oregon at this point. I am interested in the fact that the opposition to this says that public employers are not included or exempt. And I would wonder whether if they could provide a list of public employers in the state of Oregon who have 50 employees who do not provide health care.
Thank you. The next panel, Lou, Kathy, Doug, J.L. Wilson will be the final speaker.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson. Good to see you again, members of the committee that are still here with us. My name is Lou Ogden. I'm the executive director of Unified Business Oregon. We are a membership organization of businesses large and small of various types across the state of Oregon. I echo many of the comments that have been made in the interest of time, not try to talk so fast that I can't remember what I said, let alone you, and just emphasize a few things. First of all, understand, please, that there is a tremendous need for additional costs to support folks for health care. My other life, I am a health insurance broker and have been for 30 years. And I remember in the early 90s, we had the small employer health insurance program, and we offered health insurance for $50 per person. My health things have changed. And those were not the high deductibles we see today. So we clearly have a problem. However, this bill, to echo some of the concerns that have been made, the bill doesn't have the limits. So the 50 cents may not be an ongoing number. We saw just in the last session a health provider tax that was to be temporary. Now it's permanent and has increased by a third. So we do know that these can and will increase. So, yes, the bill needs to specify that it's not open-ended, number one. Number two, it doesn't relate to other insurance. So someone could be fully employed, be fully insured, take a part-time job to help close extra bills, and now that employer is faced with this additional cost for someone that's fully insured already. And the income isn't specified that I can tell. So someone could be making six figures and working a part-time job for additional income or whatever, and still the employer be subject to this. Currently, insurance under ACA is only required at 30 hours per week. It used to be in the state, it was only required, it was only allowed at 15 and a half hours per week. So this is a big departure from precedent where we've been. More importantly, let's be real. We can't look at this in isolation. We're looking at a carbon tax, the school success tax, the family leave tax, all together over $5 billion. This will add an additional amount to that. We need these funds. Let's not put them on the back of business exclusively. Let's be transparent. If you want to raise all this money, do an income tax to everybody. Everyone can share in that. It's very obvious and transparent, and people can see what they're having to pay for the benefits received. Thank you.
Good morning, Representative Nathanson and the committee. My name is Kathy Godinez. I am a benefits consultant, and I'm also a member of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. I'm here on behalf of our association. I'm not going to go over all the stuff. A lot of it was already said, 17 and a half hours. This bill is also going to affect small employers. It is not a large employer bill. I mean, it's 50 people, but small employers also can have 50 people. We're also putting another tax mandate on large employers, which the ACA has already done. And so that's another issue for them. This is a financial and administrative situation for those employers that are subject, and it's going to be very difficult. So what I thought I would talk about today is numbers. I looked at a couple of accounts that this would affect them, and so I have a group. They have 32 people enrolled in their plan. They have 43 people who are part-time. So I, in just doing numbers, the cost for them would be almost $17,000. And they already pay $52,000 in health insurance for the people that are on the plan. Another account, they have 38 full-time people that they pay premium for, but they have 46 part-time people just because it's the nature of their business. So I did another calculation there. Well, they pay already, because of their benefits and their level, $180,000 a year in premium that they pay for their full-time people. And so by adding this part-time piece, it's another $6,000 a year for them. And so I have to deal with delivering health insurance renewals every year, and this particular account's, I'm working on it right now, they're getting a 7.5% rate increase on the $180,000. So every dollar counts, and adding more to it for small employers or large employers is really significant. Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I'm Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters to express some of our concerns about the way the bill is structured. And one of those issues is this exemption for public employees or employers. We began this discussion a couple of sessions ago with a bill in the Senate Health Committee, Senate Bill 997, back in the 2017 session. If you look at the documents that were submitted in testimony for that, you'll see a chart that looks at working Oregonians on the Oregon Health Plan. And on that chart, you'll see that about 12,000 of those are public employees. These are school district employees, local government employees, and state employees. And if this is the right policy for Oregon, it's the right policy for all employers, not just private employers. And part of the reason for that is the administrative headache that some of the previous speakers have talked about. I mean, just trying to, for school districts who have substitute teachers, and they're trying to figure out which ones are working 8 hours a week and during which calendar quarter, do they qualify or don't qualify? I think it's going to be a challenge for private employers to keep track of who's eligible for this and who's not. Public employers should have that same challenge to understand the difficulty of administering a program like this. And finally, I'd just like to talk about the funding for Medicaid. I mean, there was that interim work group that tried to figure out how to close the funding gap for Medicaid. There was a $120 million hole that they were trying to fill with this, but this plan is a $500 million solution to a $120 million problem. Thank you.
Thank you. The final speaker is J.L. Wilson. Okay. That concludes the testimony for this bill. Is that correct? Yes, no one else has signed up to testify on the sheets. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2269A. And please recall that I did offer, if anyone wanted to submit their testimony, please stop in at the desk and make arrangements to have that completed this morning. Thank you all. We are adjourned.